That's the really fun part of this whole thing, is to slam that thing three times. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming to tonight's celebration of the California Book Awards. I'm Mary Ellen Hannibal, and it is my great pleasure and privilege to be the chair of the jury who decides the winners each year. All of you are presumably, probably, and thankfully readers, and know what a wonderful conversation reading is with someone you don't know who brings a piece of the world to you and who you spend time with. The pleasure of being on a jury reading scores and scores and scores of books is having lots and lots of conversations with lots and lots and lots of writers, every one of whom does, you know, a huge, effortful job. But then there's this huge pleasure of being on a jury of really passionate readers with really different points of view, because we get to have conversations with each other about our conversations with these other books and the author's sensibility. As every year, we consider just hundreds of books. The nonfiction jury this year considered 130 submissions. Most categories get down to really about 10 solid books, really at the most, and then pretty easily down to 5. To choose one winner out of those 5 is just incredibly difficult and interesting. And when we have the conversations about what those books should be, just wonderful insights come from the jurors about their experiences with the books. And every year, a sort of surprising slate of books comes out of the awards. And I'm sure you can find patterns in everything. There's, the Virgin Mary in the microwave is one of them. But every year, a sort of pattern emerges in the winners that we've chosen. And we don't choose them according to anything whatsoever except literary value, really. 2 years ago, the winners, every single book in juvenile, poetry, nonfiction, and fiction, all had a theme of diaspora, of races and families and groups of people either being forced out of homelands and into new lands, or being inculcated with new populations that changed homelands. Last year, the books, a great preponderance of them had to do with the Asian American experience in California. And that was just fascinating, because we're getting different genres. We're getting nonfiction, fiction, poetry, all of which tell their truths in different ways. So this year I sat down with the list of winners and I thought, okay, what's the pattern here? And actually there really is one. And it is truthfulness, I think. So I'm going to leave that to you to ferret out when you listen to each of these wonderful writers who's won this year tell you a little bit about their process and their project. And hopefully you'll read their books. They're all really good. And somehow truthfulness is an issue in each of them. So before I pass the gavel and the mic over to Jack Boulware, I would like to just acknowledge the jury, many of whom are here. And maybe you guys could just, I know you don't like to be looked at, but maybe you could stand up quickly and in the aggregate I can acknowledge you, and then I will read the list of the names of the jurors. So our jury this year was Justin Chin, Dean Rader, Sarah Rosenthal, Sarah Manyika, Catherine Ma, Oscar Villalon, Martha Cox. Come on, guys, stand up. Catherine Gilmartin, Grace Ruth, David Hellman, David Ulan, Alden Mudge, and Peter Fish, and myself. And there's more of them there. They haven't all stood up. Thank you. The other people to really thank very heartily are Carly and Caitlin from the Commonwealth Club, who have done a great deal to make tonight happen. And then for the overall awards, Michelle Chioda, can you stand up, young lady, because you did so much to help us out. And also Wendy Wanderman, who was our scout leader and really helped achieve the book awards this year. So now I will introduce Paul Weibley. I'm sorry, I practiced it. I loved your words about what reading means to you, and thank you for supporting the book awards. I don't think there's anything more important than sponsoring literacy, reading, and celebrating the very hard work of wonderful writers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. I have a few hundred pages of prepared remarks, as you would expect from a banker. I'm here from Bank of the West, delighted to be here tonight with many colleagues. And thank you, all of you, for joining us. Bank of the West has a long history of supporting the Commonwealth Club, direct financial contributions, membership on the board, and personally, my experience with the Commonwealth Club started when I was in high school, and I came to see Lee Iacocca speak, and I saw Caspar Weinberger speak and Ronald Reagan speak, and I realized what a great opportunity it is to see such great people come to our city, visit with us, tell us their insights, and I'm a big supporter of the Commonwealth Club. This is the bank's third time of sponsoring the book awards. I wasn't able to be here last year, but the year before I was. We bought several of the books, and one of the ones that we bought was A Paradise Built in Hell, and it turns out that that book is now one of my son's favorite books, and it sits proudly on his bookshelf in his bedroom, and that's just wonderful. Bank of the West is committed to encourage people to read and supporting authors like those that are honored this evening. In addition to sponsoring the California Book Awards, we also celebrate tonight something special, which is our relationship with Raising a Reader. Raising a Reader's mission is to engage parents in the routine of daily book cuddling with their children from birth to age 8 to foster healthy brain development, parent-child bonding, and early literacy, so critical for school success. I'd like to ask Abrielle Miller to come up to speak to us a moment about Raising a Reader. She's the National Executive Director of Raising a Reader. Come on up, Gabrielle.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having us. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of a researcher by the name of Keith Stanovich. He has coined a phrase that, when you mentioned patterns, Mary Ellen, it reminded me. The phrase that he referred to in the pattern that he saw in the research is called the Matthew effect. And what he saw was the pattern over and over again that children who have, I have to tell you what it's in reference to. It's in reference to the biblical phrase, as the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. So the analogy in literacy is when children come from literacy-rich homes and they have literacy-rich environments in every place they go, they're more likely to learn to read, and not surprisingly, they get better and better. Conversely, when children don't have those access to books or family members who share books with them, they're less likely to learn to read and be successful in life. And so it feels very overwhelming sometimes when you hear researchers like that talk about the Matthew effect and what can we do, what can we do. It turns out that very simple things can matter. Some of you may have seen on NPR last week or the week before, there was a study from University of Virginia Curry School that looked at what I call micro-interventions. But what they were doing was looking at children's eye patterns when you share a book with them. And not surprisingly, children tend to look at the images or the illustrations. But when you do very simple things like directing children to the first word in the text or the last word in the text, just directing their eyes to the text, a very simple prompt, the effects are demonstrable through second grade. And that's a very, very simple thing. So that's what our organization is very proud to do. We are able to do the work that we do because of supporters like Bank of the West and all of you. We want children all over the country, and especially in California, to develop the habit of reading together and become the readers who read your books. And so we're in the business of building readers, and we're very, very proud of it. So please know that you all have our very warmest congratulations on these awards, and we're very, very proud and very thankful for our support from Bank of the West. And so, congratulations to all of you. Thank you.
I went down to Long Beach last year to go to a Raising a Reader event and read to some students, some young kids, and it was absolutely delightful. And to see the work that you do, the way it creates new minds, new imagination, opens up so many avenues for them. It's terrific, terrific work. So I'd want to give my personal congratulations to the winners. I want to say that also on behalf of my colleagues here from Bank of the West tonight. We're in for a real treat to hear from the authors. And so, Jack, I will give the podium to you. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jack Boulware. I'm the co-founder and the director of the Lickwake Literary Festival here in San Francisco. We have a 9-day festival every year in October. We run events throughout the year. Our closing night event is a literary pub crawl through the Mission District. We produce 90 events in 3 hours, all of authors, reading, panel discussions, music, and it's all for free. Lickwake.org is the website to check that out. We also run programs in the public schools here in San Francisco. We bring authors to classrooms and give every child a free book. And we also have teen and children's programmings in our festival in October itself. That's enough of that. I think there's bookmarks, actually. You have a bit of propaganda to take back with you. And please join us in October and check out our website. And have I plugged myself enough? Is that enough? Jeez, okay. California lost a true literary figurehead this week with the passing of Ray Bradbury. As I'm sure you all know, The Martian Chronicles, Fahrenheit 451. He once wrote, "You don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. Just get people to stop reading them." I assume that Ray Bradbury wrote that. I saw it on a Facebook update by the Star Trek actor George Takei a couple of days ago. But I don't think he has any reason to lie. I think he probably did write it. But the reason I bring that up is that it reminded me of a conversation I had last year with a mobile app developer here in San Francisco. This was in the Mission District. We were out on a sidewalk in front of a bar, and we were chatting about books and phone apps and that conversation that you have and that we increasingly have. What is important is the content, this and that. Is it, what is the future going to be? And we were talking about putting the literary festival on. And at some point, he just said, "Come on, what are you doing? Nobody reads anymore." And I was shocked. All the things that go through your mind when you hear something like that. Nobody reads anymore. How do I respond to this? It seemed like an attack in a way. And, maybe I should have, asked him, what is the point of dreaming up a little stupid button on a phone that allows you to take a photo and you drop pins on a map and you send it to a friend with a secret little note and then all the monkeys in the trees chatter about it for a while and then you sell the technology to Google or Facebook, you make up millions of dollars and then you watch your staff get fired. But I didn't think about at the time. I thought of that the next morning in the shower, as we often do. What I actually said when he said, "Nobody reads anymore," I couldn't help it. The words just came out of my mouth. I said, "Can a handheld device describe what it's like to sit on a couch in a clinic waiting room surrounded by screaming, playing children while your girlfriend is in the next room getting an abortion? Can a handheld device remind you of why your father is an asshole?" And there was a pause, believe me. And I was thinking, what did I just say? Is this my defense of literature? I wanted to pull up my phone and start looking through quotes by Thoreau and all of this. But, it made me sound like this dark little man living under a bridge. But what happened is that the phone developer, he took a drag from his cigarette and he nodded and he said, "Yeah, I understand what you mean." So if any of you find yourself in a similar situation where you are in a conversation and it is your duty to defend the written word, I'm not suggesting that you go straight for the abortion asshole dad kind of rejoinder. Suss it out, read the room a little bit, But in this case, it did work for me. So keep that in mind. You don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. Just get people to stop reading them. So a few words about tonight's proceedings. The winners, you probably all know this, were announced a few months ago. So there will be no suspense tonight. There is no shrieking or gasping. There's no white-knuckled, incontinent thrill ride. This is a mature and orderly affair. Any tears you see will be for personal reasons, not surprise. And immediately following the awards, we will gather in the lobby for dessert. You can purchase all of the winning books and have them signed by the authors. My book will also be available, An Oral History of Punk Rock in the Bay Area. Now, whether you are an enthusiast of punk rock history, or perhaps you have a child who skateboards and thinks you're a capitalist tool, this book will help you understand him a little bit more. All of tonight's finalists and recipients are incredible, and I am proud to host this program where great writing is acknowledged and hard work is rewarded, even if some of it was accomplished while wearing pajamas. Or sweatpants. Okay, let's just jump into it. We begin tonight with juvenile literature. The finalists are Kadir Nelson for Heart and Soul, Susan Patrone for Luck for Good, Eugene Yelchin for Breaking Stalin's Nose, great title, and our winner tonight, born in Montreal, this author spent her long childhood winters reading, writing stories and poems, and filling the pages of her diary. She eventually moved to Los Angeles, and she is now the critically acclaimed author of several award-winning books. For her book, One Day and One Amazing Morning on Orange Street, the gold medal winner in juvenile literature goes to Joanne Rocklin. Is she here? There she is.
Youngest first, I guess. I'm so thrilled to have won this award. I want to thank all of the judges of the Juvenile Committee, Bank of the West, and the Commonwealth Club. As a kid growing up in Canada with the young queen and her gorgeous crown on the wall of every classroom, the word Commonwealth meant something different. Very austere. But today, for me, and this is a cliche, but it's true, it means the Commonwealth we share in our California literature. And the other works in my category just named are absolutely amazing, and it must have been an impossible choice. I thank my publisher, Abrams, and my agent, Aaron Murphy, and my family for encouraging me with my vision for my middle grade novel, Orange Street. When kids ask me where I get my ideas, I know that they're asking me where I get the whole shebang, the whole story, plot, characters, theme, everything. And I tell them that I only get my story by writing the darn thing every day, hour after hour, draft after draft. The long, hard work of writing gives it to me. But if they'd ask me how a story or idea begins, I would say it usually begins with something that clutches at my heart. And in the case of this book, it was an old Valencia orange tree in my backyard in Los Angeles, the most gorgeous, generous orange tree that you ever saw. And it just stood there producing and being generous and beautiful while we went about our ordinary days, hardly noticing. But after my mother died, all I really wanted to do was sit under that tree, pat my dog, maybe get up every now and then and plant a tomato or something. In other words, appreciate the moment, what I call the magic now. And I didn't really feel like writing at that time. But I love writing, and that tree eventually got me writing again as I began to imagine the stories that it could tell. I set the tree in my book in an empty lot, which gave me more stories and more questions to answer. And I set the lot in Los Angeles, a beautiful, multifaceted city that I knew I would be leaving soon. I live in Oakland now. I began to imagine children resonating to its translated name, the Angels. And I wanted to write about one street only because I believe that our streets are just as meaningful story-wise as the home and school for kids, for everyone. I like to give kids, when I visit schools, a blank map so that they can fill in the incidents and stories on their own street and write about their street. Although I write realistic fiction, I know that we all long for something magical, the extraordinary of the ordinary, filling us with awe, especially when experienced as a community. So I put kids from the past and the present in my book, and they're all gathering in that imaginary lot, each holding inside a secret worry, each comforted by the tree as I had been. And on that one amazing morning of the book's title, a simple event occurs, one engineered by the kids themselves. It's simple, but it's also amazing, because in just a few moments, surprisingly, all the stories become intertwined in the magic now. And this is the great part about writing. It was a joyful surprise to me, too, as the author. And for me, that's what makes writing healing as well as awesome in the truest sense of the word. Thank you so much for this award.
Joanne Rocklin. Our next award is for Young Adult Literature, YA Literature. The finalists are Kalman Handler for Why We Broke Up, Ransom Riggs for Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, Brian Selznick for Wonderstruck, Lawrence Yep for Dragon's Silk, and the recipient tonight is originally from Helena, Montana, my home state. There's not many of us. She now lives in Los Angeles and contributes to many publications such as The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and Granta. She has spent most of her career writing short stories and novels for adults, and her new book is the first written for young readers for her novel, The Apothecary. We give the gold medal in young adult literature to Miley Malloy.
That is the most amazing shortlist. This is such an amazing welcome to the world of kids' books. As he said, all my other books have been for adults. I'm really honored. The book, The Apothecary, is a Cold War spy novel with kids and magic. It begins against the sort of real-world setting of the Hollywood blacklist. And people told me my kids don't know anything about the Cold War or the blacklist, but I really feel that all information is new information to kids, and you don't have to write down to them because they read up. I've been talking to kids this year because of the book, and the first group I talked to was a summer book camp. They were serious readers. They were scary smart. They chose to spend their summer camp reading books. And I asked, because of the blacklist beginning, if anyone knew what the First Amendment protects, and they got speech in the press and religion right away. And I asked for one more, thinking they might get assembly. And one kid raised his hand and said, the right to petition, these are kids 9 to 12, this kid is 10. He says, the right to petition for governmental redress of grievances? I said, yes. That's the other one. But I've also talked to kids who aren't readers and haven't been readers, and I've realized how much I took it for granted that people put books in my hands early and read to me, and what a difference it makes. I'm really excited about raising a reader because I've seen the gap as I've been going around the country talking to kids between those scary smart reader kids and the kids who aren't getting books and aren't getting reading, and it's transformative. So I'm really grateful to the Commonwealth Club and to all of you jurors who read so many books, and to all of you for promoting reading and honoring books. I'm really grateful to be one of them. Thank you.
Miley Malloy. Our next award is for contribution to publishing, which honors a California-based publishing house for its contribution to the literary landscape. lot of contributions there. This book is a riveting collection of first-person and historical essays spanning San Francisco's tumultuous decade from 1968 to 1978, from the State College strike to the Jonestown Massacre and the assassinations of Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. For the book 10 Years That Shook the City, edited by Chris Carlson and Lisa Ruth Elliott, we give the gold medal in contribution to publishing to City Lights Publishers. Accepting the award will be Lisa Ruth Elliott and Elaine Katzenberger, publisher and executive director of City Lights Books.
Thank you so much for recognizing us and especially this project. I feel like I don't need to introduce City Lights to a room like this, especially here in San Francisco, but I'll just say a few words. Obviously, City Lights is a bookstore and a publisher founded by a poet, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, in 1953. So we're coming up on 60 years of counting on the fact that people do read books. And I can tell you that every day City Lights Bookstore is full of people who do read books and they buy books and they care about them a great deal. And it's full of people who make books and put books in people's hands and do it with passion. So I'm in a very lucky position that as a publisher, I actually get to wave my magic wand and bring books into the world. And that is something that I feel like has been the biggest gift in my life. So I just want to say that it's an honor to stand here in front of a bunch of people who create them and who care about them as much or as even more maybe than I do. I don't know how that's possible, but it's really wonderful to be recognized in this way. And I want to let Lisa Ruth tell you about this project. City Lights has had a collaboration with Chris Carlson and now Lisa Ruth and Shaping San Francisco since 1995. We published our first collection with them called Reclaiming San Francisco that was a similar project, ground up histories, first person accounts of San Francisco, and followed that in 2005 with a book called The Political Edge, which told the stories around a sort of upsurge in political activity when Matt Gonzalez challenged Gavin Newsom for the election in San Francisco. And when Chris approached me with this project, it just seemed like a natural, and it is a natural project for City Lights. We've always supported radical culture and first-person accounts and sort of fringe elements or what are considered fringe elements of society. So we're really proud to have published this book, and I'm glad that this is the reason why we're being honored tonight. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Elaine. We're really grateful for your commitment to that kind of history being out there. And on behalf of the editor, Chris Carlson, and as co-producer and co-editor of this book, I would like to thank the California Book Awards jury in honoring City Lights Books for this publication. We're happy to continue this relationship with City Lights and thank them for their commitment to documenting San Francisco's history as told by the people who make that history. I'd also like to thank the authors who contributed their memories and experiences of the various social movements that they experienced during that time. There are also some of them here in the audience tonight. With this book, we chose to tell the stories of the decade 1968 to 1978 because the values that were being examined then and reevaluated and remade through radical and community history or community organizing during that time, they're so influential on the way that we accept as given what we the society we live in today. So we found it really important to put this book out there so you could read about all of the experiences as well and identify yourself as related to those. We added a 10 years audio walking tour through the Mission District, and it's designed to complement and expand the experience of this book. So we hope you'll look for it on foundsf.org online. Thanks so much.
Lisa Ruth Elliott, Elaine Katzenberger, City Lights Books. Our next award honors the writer who best discusses an aspect of the Golden State. It's called the Californiana Award. Since 1970, this writer has published 17 books on natural history and conservation, and his work has appeared everywhere from the Norton Anthology of Nature Writing to the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Harper's, Mother Jones, Greenpeace, and Sierra Magazine. In this new book, the author turns his attention to another distinctive corner of California, its desert, the driest and hottest environment in North America. For his book, Chuckawalla Land, The Riddle of California's Desert, we give the gold medal for Californiana to David Raines Wallace.
As a full-time writer about nature and stuff like that, I feel a certain kinship with species like the sea otter. In that paraphrase, Mark Twain, reports of our extinction have been exaggerated. My literary species extinction was reported around the time I published my first book in 1978, when an editorial in Audubon magazine said full-time writers about nature were going to vanish in the late 20th century. The first book is a tough act to follow, and this was not encouraging. So I was very relieved when I opened my mailbox one day in 1979 to find evidence of my continued existence. The news that the Commonwealth Club of California had awarded a medal to my first book, The Dark Range. I still feel kinship with California's sea otters, since it's not just the first book that's a tough act to follow. So I was relieved when I opened my email one day in 2012 to find evidence of my continued existence. The news that the Commonwealth Club of California had awarded a medal to my latest book. I think it's accurate to say that my gratitude to the Commonwealth Club is deep in time as well as wide in space. Of course, unpublished books don't get many medals, so I'd also like to say thanks to the University of California Press, which published not only Chuckawalla Land, but several others of mine, with special thanks to my editors, Blake Edgar, who's here tonight, and Cindy Fulton. And books don't get published if they don't get written. So I have thanks to bestow there, too. Isaac Newton said he'd only been able to make discoveries by standing on the shoulders of giants. Anyone who wants to discover the California desert today has to stand on a regular skyscraper of giants. From early naturalists like Miguel Del Marco to writers like Mary Austin to scientists like G. Ledyard Stebbins. That wouldn't be possible without libraries. And I'd like to give special thanks to the University of California system, particularly the Berkeley Bioscience and Bancroft libraries. Last but not least, I'd like to thank the conservationists, public servants, and legislators who have worked so hard to keep the California desert alive and to keep it accessible to a public that needs its serenity and beauty more all the time.
David Raines Wallace, and here's his award. We were just about to auction that off. Our next award is for poetry, and the finalists are Mika Ballard for Waifs and Strays, Camille T. Dungy for Smith Blue, Ray Guerin, hope I'm not butchering that, for Open Winter, Jeff Hoffman for Journal of American Foreign Policy. Our winner tonight is a poet, teacher, and founding editor of Nocturne's Review of the Literary Arts, a journal dedicated to the work of artists and writers of the African diaspora and other contested spaces. Her work has appeared in numerous anthologies and collections, as well as on the building of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. That's pretty cool. Her new book of poetry delivers profound meditations on the nature of the self. For her collection titled Ascension, we give the gold medal in poetry to Giovanni Singleton.
Do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things that life is showing you? Where are you going to? Do you know?
I didn't know when leaving the Commonwealth of Virginia and stepping from the California Ziffer 18 years ago that I would one day be here at the Commonwealth Club of California, accepting a California Book Award, for which I am deeply honored. My elementary school in Richmond was around the corner from another public forum, the church where Patrick Henry delivered his "Give me liberty or give me death" speech, leading the Virginia troops into the Revolutionary War. Black girl, you a black girl. Black girl, jump down, turn around. Arriving a bit late for the gold rush, or so I thought, I came to seek my poetic fortune in the Golden State, a place where I knew no one. A journey from revolution to innovation. But writing has kept me company, has planted the roots of home. How the heart is the seat of true wisdom. After graduate school, I stopped writing for over a decade in search of the roots of truth. During this time, I started Nocturne's Review of the Literary Arts and began teaching poetry to kids. They say the darndest things. When I was 9 years old, I killed a bird, he said, to see what was inside. With the death of musician Ellis Coltrane, when I thought I was praying, some poems came out. An eighth grader, upon hearing about the publication of my book, Ascension, offered a recipe for courage. Be curious, seek the unseen. Ascension has helped me to make sense of the world, its headlines, its reality TV, the wild turkeys who this week mistook themselves for roosters and woke me up. One is humbled by how to be human. A woman goes up a road a ways, and a button falls from her one good dress. How to witness. I'd like to thank my mom for her kindness and love. She never tires of wonder. She never tires of wondering, Lord, what is my child up to now? I also thank our family matriarch, my grandmother, and the rest of my family, including my Uncle Leon, with whom I once wrote a fable starring a mint julep sipping egret named Elijah. I also especially thank Brenda Hillman, who displayed the patience of Job for well over a decade and helped Ascension find a home. I thank my publisher, Counterpath Press, my Aunt Anna, who, before she died, cautioned, remember now, you're not going to be everybody's cup of tea. And so I extend my sincerest gratitude to the jury for taking time to listen to the silence of my one cup of tea. I thank wonderfully supportive friends, many of who are here tonight, and they gave me various forms of refuge over many years. I thank the poet Lucille Clifton and the musician Alice Coltrane, courageous trailblazers both. I also thank the amazing Robert Haas, with whom I have the pleasure of coordinating the Lunch Poem series at UC Berkeley. And a deep bow to the ancestors and elders upon whose shoulders I stand, light into lungs. Thank you.
Giovanni Singleton. We move on to First Fiction now. It's a very important award which honors a writer for a strong first effort in the fiction category. The finalists are Will Boast for Power Ballads, Michael David Lucas for the Oracle of Stamboul, and our next winner is an award-winning writer and university creative writing instructor at both Stanford and San Francisco State Universities. Her new novel has become a New York Times, NPR, and American Independent Booksellers Association bestseller within a month of release. And on a side note, she is appearing at a Lickwake event on June 26th. Just make a quick note of that. For her book, Turn of Mind, the gold medal and first work of fiction goes to Alice LaPlante.
I didn't set out to write a mystery. As a literary writer, I was kind of chagrined to find myself doing so. The subject is Alzheimer's. My mother has had Alzheimer's for more than a decade, and I've been trying to write about it in various guises, fiction, short stories, nonfiction, memoir, you name it. I could never get at the material that I wanted to get at the truth of the disease of the sufferers. I wanted to put the reader in the position of having Alzheimer's. I couldn't get it to work in a literary setting. For one thing, there was no plot trajectory. It just went straight down. I thought no one would read it. So my family's in Chicago, and I'd go every 6 weeks or so to visit and help out however I could with my mother. And I'd come back from one particularly brutal trip, and my partner and I were collapsed on the couch watching our KQED Friday Night Mysteries. And he says, "Forget about this literary crap. Write a mystery." I said, I can't. I'm not smart enough. I said, "But wouldn't it be funny to have a mystery in which the detective had Alzheimer's and couldn't remember the clues?" And he said, "Why don't you write that?" I said, "I can't." I said, "But I think I can write it from the point of view of the suspect." And I sat down and started writing it. And the stuff that I wanted to write at, oddly enough, came out in this mystery framework. And the way I think about the mystery part of the story now is it's a series of breadcrumbs going into a very, very dark forest that no one wants to go into. I didn't want to go there. No reader would want to go there. But the breadcrumbs make it safer. As I've been on tour and as I've continued to talk about the book, I had one puzzling reaction that's come up time and time again. People have come up to me and said, "Your book made me feel so much better. My mother has Alzheimer's. My father had Alzheimer's. And your book made me feel better." And I thought they were nuts. But it was on my last night of tour that a bookseller and I sat down, and she explained to me what they were talking about. The book is my fantasy, right, about what Alzheimer's feels like, what it must be like to deteriorate in that particular way. She said, "Your fantasy is that at the end," I'm not giving away the mystery of it in any way, "but your fantasy is that at the end, the person is still there. They might not be able to communicate. They might not show any signs, but they're still there." And I guess that's what I wanted to believe. So thank you. My deep gratitude. I'm greatly honored for this award. The book is dedicated to my mother, Alice Gervais O'Neill, who passed away this last week. But I want to dedicate this to my father, William Albert LaPlante, who is the real hero. He took care of her till the end and kept her at home. And the caregivers are the real heroes in these stories that we hear. Thank you very much.
Alice LaPlante. It's time to now award the medals for nonfiction. Our first recipient is a New York Times bestselling author of 8 novels and has been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, Rolling Stone, Esquire, The New York Times. His most recent book, a collection of previously published and new pieces, covers an array of cultural topics from graffiti to 9/11, cell phones, Norman Mailer, Shirley Jackson, Paula Fox, and yes, the buttocks of Donald Sutherland. I swear to God. For his book, The Ecstasy of Influence, we award the Silver Medal in Nonfiction to Jonathan Lethem, and here to accept his award tonight is his cousin, McSweeney's editor, Michelle Quint.
Yeah, Jonathan regrets that he can't be here tonight, so he asked me to read a few words on his behalf. To the administrators and hosts and jurors of the California Book Award, and to my fellow honorees, how sorry I am to not be among you this evening to accept this delightful honor in person. It thrills me to no end, really, to be recognized as a California writer at this moment when I've so recently resumed my life as a bona fide Californian, he wrote, sitting in a farmhouse in coastal Maine. When I first arrived in the Bay Area in 1985, it was only after having dwelled already in a California of my yearning imagination, fueled by the Beats, by Hollywood, by Raymond Chandler, and by Philip K. Dick. I then made my apprenticeship in Berkeley and Oakland and set the majority of my first 3 novels on that turf as well. And I continued to be amazed at how much of my own life seemed to be waiting on the West Coast for me to arrive and recognize it. So the gift of this award seems to me to reflect the spirit of a colonist recognition turned inside out. Thank you.
Jonathan Lethem accepting Michelle Quint. Our next book was co-authored by 2 investigative reporters for the Los Angeles Times. Both were Pulitzer Prize finalists in 2006 for exposing the role of the J. Paul Getty Museum and other American museums, buying stolen treasures on the black market. Their dedicated research and reporting is the basis for this new book. For Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum, the gold medal in nonfiction goes to Jason Felch and Ralph Framolino. Accepting Mr. Framolino's award will be his daughter, Allison.
Thank you all very much. Ralph and I are very honored to have received this award. Allison's going to say some words on Ralph's behalf in a moment. It was about 12 years ago that I was living here in San Francisco and working just a block and a half from here. I was running an after-school program for refugee teens and trying to figure out how to become a writer. I was submitting what I thought were rather lofty articles to publications like The Atlantic and Harper's and getting back one-sentence rejection letters and not quite sure of how to get to some place like this today. So when I learned that I was going to receive this award, I thought, well, what was it? What got me here from there not that long ago? And I was certain that it wasn't some magic literary skill that I'd been born with. It wasn't some innate talent. It wasn't as much as my parents who are here tonight encouraged reading. It wasn't some passion for reading that got me here. Ultimately, what I think got me here tonight is stubbornness. It was stubbornness that allowed me to keep trying to write when lots of indications suggested that I couldn't write or shouldn't write. It was stubbornness that encouraged me or allowed me maybe to spend 3 years writing a screenplay, which is thankfully safely in a desk drawer at home where it belongs, but to work on that for 3 years with a colleague here in town and to try to make it better and better over years. It was stubbornness that kept me writing for years without being published and to keep doing that until I eventually went to journalism school and got a job at the LA Times. And once I got to the LA Times, it was stubbornness that really put me on a quest for truth. I think it was Hemingway who said that he wanted to write one true sentence in his lifetime. Investigative reporters want to find that one glimpse of reality, that one peek behind the curtains that really lets us inside the boardroom, inside those private conversations to see how the world really works. And so it was that stubbornness that fueled Ralph and I, as colleagues together at the LA Times, to try to get to the bottom of what was going on in the world's richest museum, the J. Paul Getty Museum. At a time of a lot of turbulence there, we got word that the real problem was not the administrative foibles and self-dealing that we had spent a year writing about, and the J. Paul Getty Trust CEO who had been misusing all the Getty's money. It wasn't that. In fact, the real story, we were told, was in the Antiquities Department, in the collection of ancient art that the museum had built rather quickly over the last 40 years. Ralph and I didn't know anything about ancient art. We really didn't know much about art. Although that screenplay that was in my drawer was called The End of Art, I think back now. So we set about our quest of trying to find the truth and trying to get to the bottom of that. And it was there were a lot of obstacles in that quest. Museums are very private places. They claim to operate in our benefit, but in fact, they're very secretive about the way they do business. If you go to your local museum, they won't tell you what they bought it for. They'll tell you who it was made by and more or less what year it was made. And the real story they won't tell you is how that piece of art got to your local museum. And that's the story that we were trying to find out. We were trying to figure out how all of this gorgeous ancient art that had been made by Greeks and Romans 2,500 years ago, how that had gotten to the shelves of the Getty Museum. That's the story that we tell in Chasing Aphrodite. It's a sordid tale. There's all the hallmarks of the stories you've been reading about involving Wall Street. There's elements of the steroid scandal in Major League Baseball, where you have a hidden secret. There's even a hint of the scandal that racked the Catholic Church involving pedophile priests, where you've got a systemic problem in the museum community that everybody in that world knows about, but the public is largely in the dark about. All of those elements end up being in Chasing Aphrodite, and you I think, reach the end, and you see that there's a story here that that took a lot of digging to get to. And so tonight I want to thank, first of all, our sources, the people who gave us that window. There are people whose names are never acknowledged publicly because they risked everything to help us tell the stories that we tell. So I want to thank them, but I won't name them. I want to thank my co-author, Ralph Framolino, over the course of 5 years of reporting and writing this book. Ralph and I differed on many things, but we shared that stubbornness. We shared that passion to get to the bottom of it. And indeed, several years into this, when we turned in our manuscript and the publisher kind of gave us an email high five and said, "You guys are done," it was stubbornness that made us take the manuscript back and work on it for another year, because it wasn't up to our standards in terms of the writing. We really wanted it to be a story that you could read through quickly, and I think we achieved that. Most of all, I wanted to thank my family, which has had to live with this stubbornness of mine for going on 39 years. Three of my four mothers are here tonight. My father's here tonight. My lovely sister Kristen is here tonight. My in-laws, Alfonso Maria, who supported me both emotionally and financially in the early days of this book and made that possible. And most of all, my lovely wife, Anai, who's here tonight, because she had to put up with the stubbornness and put up with me for 5 years while we were working on this book. And without her, it would not have been possible. So thank you all very much. I appreciate this award, and I appreciate the recognition of this kind of work.
Thank you for having me speak on behalf of my father. From the perspective of a child, your parents' voice is always in your head. When you're trying to do something that maybe you think you shouldn't, when you're doing something that you think is a good thing to be doing, and it's a different thrill entirely to hear it come to you from words on a page. So I'm very, very proud of him. So this is his note to you. To the officers, members, and distinguished guests of the Commonwealth Club, unfortunately, I'm in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and can't be with you tonight, but I have asked my daughter Allison to represent me. I wish to thank you for this great honor, the California Book Award Gold Medal for Nonfiction. From the beginning, Jason and I were gripped by the unfolding story about how some of the smartest people at the world's richest art institution sacrificed truth for beauty. The story was so powerful, so intricate, that it resisted the constraints of newspaper journalism. It needed a book. The result was Chasing Aphrodite. Our goal was to render a somewhat arcane subject into a thoroughly documented, compelling narrative, and with it, make people aware of how American museums were complicit in a multi-billion-dollar illicit trade. Your recognition tonight validates our effort. Most of all, it brings us one step closer to ending the pernicious strip mining of the world's cultural heritage. Thank you.
Here's to stubbornness. Long may it reign. Now it's time to award the medals for fiction. The silver medal finalists, I believe that's where I am. This is a professional show here, so... Okay, yes. The awards for fiction. The silver medal finalists are Chris Adrian for The Great Night, Danzy Senna for You Are Free, David Foster Wallace for The Pale King. And the recipient tonight, this writer, is the author of two widely praised works of fiction, Esther Stories and The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, as well as the editor of two nonfiction books, Underground America and Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. His work has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly and the Best American Short Stories, and he has received two Pushcart Prizes. For the novel Love and Shame and Love, we award a silver medal in fiction to Peter Orner.
I'm so honored to be here tonight, and I'm honored especially that the Commonwealth Club chose a book that's so unabashedly about Chicago. It's people, it's politics, and all its love gone wrong. But I'm sure, in fact, I know there are more than a few Chicagoans in the room because we're everywhere. Alice LaPlante, Ray Bradbury, a Californian, also a Chicagoan. Waukegan, but close enough, 40 miles north. But this is the great genius of California. I think it's that you can be from here even when you're not. You can be from here even when you're not from here. You know what I mean? Even though I flubbed my own line that I wrote 17 times. But I think that this is a really rare thing. Think about all the places where this is simply not the case. But in California, it really is. I tend to write looking in the rearview mirror. So I sat in my cold garage in Bernal Heights, not far from here, and I thought about swimming in Lake Michigan in November, which wasn't a stretch. I'm not quite ready to look back at the 12 years I've lived in California, but I hope to one day. California, like Chicago, is in large part mythical, but you still have to learn the myth well enough to explode it, which I see as a big part of our job and one that I tried to do in this novel. Love the myth, blow it up. A couple of years ago, my daughter was born, and I remember looking out the window of the hospital at the Geary bus going by, and I thought, damn, my kid's a Californian. So I'm getting a step closer to really, really knowing the lay of the land here. And tonight I feel especially that's the case even more so. I want to thank my editor, Pat Strawn at Little Brown, a legendary editor who allows me the freedom to write unorthodox books, and also my family, who can't be here tonight because they're in Massachusetts, the novelist Katie Crouch and our daughter Phoebe. And really, thank you very much to the jury and all the readers and you all tonight. Thank you very much.
Peter Orner. Our gold medalist in the category of fiction has worked as a journalist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times for nearly 20 years, very different papers. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of the 1992 riots, and he has served as bureau chief in both Buenos Aires and Mexico City. His new novel, explores the boundaries that bind and divide families, neighborhoods, and Southern Californians, and has been called a work of extraordinary scope and extraordinary power. For the book, The Barbarian Nurseries, the gold medal in fiction goes to Hector Tobar.
Thank you for this wonderful honor. Thank you to the jurors and to the Commonwealth Club. It's such a great honor to be included among these amazing finalists, including the late, great David Foster Wallace. I was truly honored just to be included in that list of writers. And I'd like to begin my brief remarks by recognizing three native Californians who helped bring this book into being. First, my agent, Jay Mandel at William Morris Endeavor. My editor at FSG, Sean McDonald, and my long-suffering wife, the Angelina Dr. Virginia Espino. This book, in its original form, was rejected by every publisher in New York, San Francisco, North Carolina, and Minneapolis in the late 1990s. I rewrote it starting in 2005, and those three Californians, those three people, were witnesses to that process, and I thank them for not losing hope in me. It's a hard thing to hold on to hope when you write a novel. No one pays you to write a novel ahead of time unless you're one of five or six people in the United States. And they all stood by me, and I truly appreciate that. And I think that they were optimistic because, like me, they are children of California. I am a son of California, and I am especially grateful to receive an honor called the California Book Award because the book in my immigrant family, in my California family, has always stood for certain ideals. The book has symbolized our aspirations. In our family of humble roots, the book has always been a powerful and a sacred object. My father, a Guatemalan immigrant, arrived in Los Angeles at the age of 21 with only a sixth grade education, having owned only one book his entire life. La Historia del Imperio Romano, it was called. That book was his education from the time he was 11 until he was 21. His own mother, my grandmother, Valeria Cruz, was illiterate. A secret my father kept from me until my third book, The Barbarian Nurseries, was published. When I was 11 years old, my father gave me a copy of the first truly big, truly awesome book I ever owned, a copy of the American Heritage Dictionary, first edition. Now I see the deep meaning behind that gift. My father, a man whose mother could not write or read a single word in any language, was giving his son all the words in English. And I've held on to that love of words for my entire life. From California public schools in Southern California to UC Santa Cruz, to the Mission District, where I edited a bilingual newspaper called El Tecolote, to the outstanding MFA program at UC Irvine, to that often great, often confounding, sometimes literary institution of California known as the Los Angeles Times. This novel, which you recognize today, is the product of a personal, multi-generational struggle to master the word. But it's also a small recognition of Centroamericanos and of the contribution of the Central American diaspora to the culture of the West. And I'm proud to accept it in the name of the people of the Isthmus, the people of Vos, in the name of Patojos, and of El Pulgarcito de America. That's El Salvador, the little finger of America. And finally, The Barbarian Nurseries is my own personal therapy session with the legacy of being a Californian. It's about a Mexican woman, a maid, who is an intellectual trapped in the body of a servant. She is my alter ego. I am an intellectual inside the body of a Guatemalteco who has been liberated from this condition of servitude by the state of California. being a son of this insane, brilliant, wounded, and free-spirited state made me the writer that I am today. It gave me a vision that's optimistic and dark, that's playful and demented, and also unfailingly empathetic. That's what it means to be a California writer in these days of great opportunity and of great subtractions. In this time of great diversity and of cruel austerities. California is crazier than ever and as golden as ever. And in the name of its insanity and in the name of its still rampant possibilities, I gratefully accept this award. Thank you for your support of the book and for your support of California literature. Buenas noches.
Hector Chovar. So thank you so much for celebrating some of the great literary works of 2011 with us and helping commemorate our 81st annual California Book Awards. Thank you as well to Bank of the West for their generous support and to Dr. Martha Cox. We will see you at the dessert reception. Please buy and read the winners' books. That's why they write them. Thank you for supporting the written word. I'm Jack Boulware, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.